poetry parses what we inherit and what we bequeath.
When my father is gone and when I go, there's another, my daughter, who may have to fight in similar ways. She may have to rebel in similar ways, but she will do it from her own plot, a governess unto herself. We aren't going anywhere.
That's William Evans. We talk with him about his powerful new collection of poetry, We Inherit What the Fires Left. Then we talk with antitrust policy analyst and author Matt Stoller about his blog post, Antitrust After the Coronavirus, A Government of Corporate Monopolies. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Well, it's the last week of Poetry Month, just in time to squeeze in the wonderful conversation I recorded a few days ago with award-winning poet William Evans. It's about his new poetry volume out from Simon & Schuster, We Inherit What the Fires Left. In the book, Evans explores the lived experience of race in the American suburbs and what dreams and injuries are passed from generation to generation. He examines not only what these inheritances are composed of, but what price the bearer must pay for such legacies. In our interview, he shares his struggles as a parent over how to talk with his young daughter about the ugly realities of racism in America without damaging her spirit. William Evans is the author of two previous poetry collections and is the founder of the Righting Wrongs Poetry Slam in Columbus, Ohio. Well, William Evans, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here. With all the circumstances, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. I actually looked on you. You're the co-founder of a website called Black Nerd Problems, and I went on it before we started, and I noticed there's an awful lot on there about keeping kids amused with good movies. Is that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we comment on, I mean, the point of the website was we wanted to have a diverse range of voices for, you know, the content on pop culture and things like that. And so because we talk about movies and TV and anime and comic books and all these things, a lot of people are occupying themselves with those things like right now. So one of the things we've been doing is like a lot of recommendations and things to kind of keep your attention through this.
That's great. So let's talk about this wonderful poetry volume, We Inherit What the Fires Left. This is not your first, is that right?
No. It's my first, I guess you would say, on a big publication. But no, I have a couple collections previous to this. This kind of felt like the maturation of some of those themes that I was hitting on before. You know, I kind of talked about becoming a father, and of course we're going back some years, and my daughter is 8 now. So I want to say about two books back is like when I was like father of a newborn and kind of trying to experience that. And still the previous book focused a lot about being a father. But this felt more well-rounded to me, and it felt like a deeper cut into my own family history and how that informs me being in my present situation as a father and a husband and living in the neighborhood that I do. And so this kind of felt like the maturation of a lot of those themes that I hit on in previous collections.
And so, of course, Inherit is in the title, and you have 6 poems titled Inheritance.
I do.
In different sections of the book. But none of the poems are titled We Inherit What the Fires Left. So I wanted to ask you about that title.
Yeah. When I started to write poems, and the way that this book kind of came together is that I kind of just became obsessed with this theme of inheritance. And especially, you know, for me, I'm middle-aged Black man living in kind of middle America. And it stemmed from a conversation I had with my father about he owns this land. And he, you know, he said, hey, you know, just kind of making it very plain that I was going to inherit this from him one day. And I kind of thought about the uniqueness of my situation, that there's not a lot of Black folks my age that are inheriting things of any kind of wealth or a value of that magnitude. And so it kind of led me to thinking about this, which kind of led me to reading up more about like generational wealth and the wealth gap and things like that in our country. And so I started to write more around that and write around poems about that. And then as I thought about that more, I was like, well, you know, I've been thinking about inheritance from a pretty monetary standpoint, but inheritance means all these things, experiences, traumas, stories, mythologies, things like that. And so because of the things, and some of them are hit on in the book, some of the things that like my parents went through and specifically my dad, the title felt appropriate of picking up in the aftermath of like the things that my parents or the previous generation from me had to go through and what we take away from that. So that's where the title of the book came from, even though there's no poem specifically for that. But I felt that that did encapsulate a lot of what was going on in the book in terms of moving through generations and what we take from the previous generation.
So the fires, are they the fires that raged in the 60s? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, even more so than that. I mean, my parents, you know, grew up in the 60s and 70s, or in the 60s specifically. I was born in the end of the 70s, but even closer to home than that, you know, and there's some poems specifically about this in the book of, we lived in the city when I was very young, and then we moved to the suburbs, and it was a big shock for me. The racial mix of the neighborhoods I lived in was completely different than I experienced before. And I think when I wrote about these things previously, I kind of always wrote from my own experience, right? Obviously, you know, my transition and my dealing with that and the things that I had to deal with and the things that I wasn't so great at dealing with. But this book, I explored a little bit more of like what my parents experienced, right? And, you know, I talk in the book about code switching and mannerisms and policing oneself. And a lot of the things that I still find myself wandering into now are things that I tried to explore in the book that I was now being more aware of what my parents go through. So, I mean, the fires can be the 60s, but they were also, you know, as recent as the 90s, right? As far as what it took for them to raise a family in that kind of environment where there was lots of microaggressions or macro, and their challenges for kind of trying to give our family, and I have one younger sister, trying to give our family the best possibilities, but what it actually cost them from a social standpoint as well.
That's so interesting, because I read a lot of those poems as being your experience, but you're saying now that they're your father's experience.
Yeah, I mean, some of them, and then they cross over, right? So specifically, I'm thinking of, there's a poem in there called Still Ain't Life, which is about my mother getting upset with me when I'm using slang at the table at one of my father's bosses, right? And, you know, previously when I would write that poem, it would be 100%, and it's still very much slanted to my experience. But I think in writing that poem, it helped me kind of realize like what was at stake for my parents, right? And I think about, you know, there's a poem in the book, Acres, I'm not sure where in placement in the book it is, but it really specifically talks about my father living out on this land, right? And of course, my perspective of is, you know, what am I going to do with this land when it is my determination of what happens with it versus like, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears that he's poured into it and what his ideals of it are and what mine are. And so the book is still written mostly from the I voice. It is the speaker is, you know, identifying close to myself. But what I wanted to do, and hopefully was showed more of a throughput of experiences specifically that happened with my father that informs some of the experiences that I either recognize now or I'm going through similarly. So I wanted there to be some crossover. I wanted to be there to be some parallelism between my father and I in a lot of those poems.
Right. Your inheritance, in other words.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and that third section in which that poem Acres is in is called, the section is called Aging Out of Someone Else's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that section and what you mean by aging out of someone else's dream and what that means for you.
Yeah, and I think that line, I hope I'm correct. I think that line specifically comes out of Acres, but that section really, it deals a little bit with my father. And I talk about my father a lot, I think, in the previous sections too. But it really, the ideal of the poems around that is what I envision for my daughter may or may not be what happens, right? And kind of coming to this realization of kind of letting go of what you think a perfect path or a utopian path or the easiest path or whatever that may be for your child. And so there's some poems that kind of hit on that in that last section, specifically like the last poem, Lore. I talk about like that kind of the idea of self-determination and what being a father is meant to me and how that may not necessarily – it isn't always going to be the same for my daughter, but in writing those poems, I kind of learned like this is a thing that happened with my dad, right? My dad grew up in rural parts of Ohio. He loves being out in the country. He would want nothing more than for me to like, I don't know, move my family out there on that land, you know, when it's all said and done, but that's not who I am. And so a lot of that section kind of, for me, dealt with transition between what your ideals are as a parent versus what they may or may not be for your child. And so a lot of those poems I tried to position, like, you know, the relationship between me and my daughter, but I realized in writing a lot of that probably applied to my father and I. And so I thought that was an appropriate line to pull to title that section. And that's kind of where I wanted to leave that book going, in terms of like, here are my ideals, becoming fully aware that these may not be the things that end up, you know, permeating into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Rarely do, as a matter of fact.
Right. Which makes sense, but it's when you're in the moment, you know, you pour a lot of your efforts and energy and time into trying to do that and not necessarily making, you know, a straight path and this is what my child is going to do, but at least allowing it these possibilities and you don't know what they're going to gravitate towards, right? My wife and I, you know, talk about this all the time. And so I hope that came out in the writing of this idea of wanting a thing and having no idea if that's actually what's going to transpire as far as generations. And I hope that kind of was reflected, especially in the relationship between my father and I.
If you're just joining Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet William Evans about his new poetry volume, We Inherit What the Fires Left. And let's now talk about your daughter. We'll come back to your dad in a bit, but I'd like, you know, I love when I interview poets, the real treat about it is to have them actually read their poetry. Do you have the book there?
Yes, I do.
So I wonder, since we've been talking about your daughter, Pledge to Raising a Black Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder if you could read that.
Sure. Let me get there. Pledge to Raising a Black Girl. You would have thought we set that girl on fire, how she got so cocky, smart as a broken window. We kept telling people how hard it is to raise a child who keeps figuring out how to make more trouble. And they just laughed like, wonder where she got that from. Wasn't much of a question as much as politely calling us a problem with a solution barely worth the effort. Do you know how many classrooms I either dulled my sharp or dulled my black until I got tired of being the only kingdom without its own campaign? How do you know what you have a taste for if you've been told never to show your teeth? This time I swaddled her in old blues and new blues and several choruses I don't plan on being present for. The elders want us to raise girls with a song in their heart, but we only respect the classics if they respected us, which is why if you ask me how I'm doing, I say still breathing. If you ask me how I've been, I say less. Plotting takes a man away from the simple things like smiling on cue. So I tossed it into a pile of things she doesn't need. Can't be mad at the talk back because we did teach her to talk shit even if she ain't allowed to say that yet. She still wears all the pink she can claim. When I say she's in training, I don't mean to take over the world or just this one world or that the proper lighting is something you have to pull from the sky itself. I mean, if there's anything I'm perfect at, it's still being alive. And maybe that's worth passing on. Maybe she doesn't mind reminding people every day how impossible that is.
That's just such a lovely poem. And
Thank you. You
really get a sense of the spirit of this girl. And, you know, it's not always easy to raise a spirited child.
No.
But it is so worth it.
I mean, in that poem, I wrote that, yeah, because she is spirited. And one of the things I worry about, and one of the things that I know I dealt with, and I see a lot, because I do a lot of going into classrooms, teaching workshops, working with schools, kind of at all kind of different levels, right? And I would love to say that it's not the fact, but I've seen it with my own eyes. You know, not everyone is awarded or afforded the same level of energy or excitement or leeway, right? And so I've seen, you know, been in classrooms where I've seen specifically girls, and even sometimes more specifically Black girls, that they are not given the same allowances for their enthusiasm or their energy or whatever in the classroom as some of their counterparts, right? I push back and I talk about this in media and things all the time. There's always like the trope on a TV show of like the cocky guy, right? Like he's the cocky guy and he's really good at what he does and people give him leeway and they talk about him, but he's really good. And of course he's cocky because he's great, right? And we just don't give specifically like young women that same allowance. And so I worry about that. I worry about that with my daughter because she is as energetic and free and she knows all the answers. And I don't, you know, I remember being called a show off because I answer questions in class. Right. And so these are the things I kind of worry about. And I wanted that to be encapsulated in this poem of the things that she is and the things that's perfectly fine and things that I want to indulge rather than tell her it's not okay.
Yeah, that's so true. But I wanted to ask you about a line in this poem because, you know, it's also something that you say you experienced, that you got tired of being the only kingdom without its own campaign. Could you talk more about what that means?
Yeah, I mean, so I want to say this I definitely experienced when my family moved to the suburbs. So now I went from being in a classroom where most of the kids look like me, talk like me, act like me, whatever. And now I'm in a classroom where, you know, I think in my graduating class, I grew up in, or I went to high school in a suburb of Columbus in Dublin. Dublin, when I went there, I think the demographic has changed. But when I was there, Dublin was about 94% white. And my graduating class, I think there was about 200 people in my graduating class. I think about six of us were Black in total, or six of us were people of color. And so there was almost never a time almost every class I was the only Black kid in there. And I remember answering questions or getting involved in discussions. And I wasn't a particularly outgoing kid when I was in high school, so I wasn't like a class clown and I wasn't talking over people or anything like that. I was actually the opposite. But when I got interested in answering questions and things I knew and things I was excited about in school, then I did. And I remember multiple times being told to stop showing off in class. And I was like, but I'm just answering the question that you asked and no one else was answering. No one else wanted to raise their hand, you know? And I think as a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid, I just internalized that and just said, oh, I guess I'm showing off because I know the answer to something. And it wasn't until much later, I was like, I don't think that's what was happening, right? And so I think a lot about how outgoing or outspoken marginalized people are treated as far as what the perception is. And so, yeah, I definitely felt like, and by the time I was a senior, I stopped answering questions. Like I just completely internalized that. I was in three AP classes my senior year and I just never got involved with class discussions because I thought if I talked up, I was, you know, showing up to class or disrupting the class or anything. And so I just was so quiet at the end of my high school years. And I just internalized that. And it took me a while, like actually going back and thinking like, actually, I don't think I was the one at fault there. And so I think about that and seeing it play out in real time when I'm in classrooms and the way that teachers interact with their students, I feel very confident saying that that was not a fluke or something that I imagined. And so, yeah, there was definitely a line there, and that's, you know, that may or may not be something that she, hopefully, that she doesn't inherit from me. But we don't always get to pick those things.
Also, another theme in this, and I think you've broached it now, is the theme of the, you know, those, I guess you could call them microaggressions. I mean, that seems like such a strange term in a way, because a microaggression can turn into a macroaggression.
Oh, absolutely.
Instantaneously. So, you know, the theme of, I didn't know even how to call it, the overweening attention of the police. I wonder if you could read the poem Waves.
Yeah. This was actually one of the first poems that I knew was going to be in the book. This felt like, even though it's a short poem, it felt like the intersection of a lot of the things that I was talking about in the book. So, yeah, Waves. At the beach where the Atlantic kisses our feet, my daughter asked me what the ocean will bring to shore, like it has secrets it holds on to. I say, under my breath, probably slaves. And I know this is me at my most cynical, a trait my child shouldn't need to be helped with. I bury my tongue behind my teeth like so many shells before me and remember what lessons I give without ever offering. On the ride home, after I've quieted the bark, an officer pulls us to the side of the road and asks me whose car I am driving my family home in.
Yeah, and it's not the first time that a policeman comes to you. Another poem has to do where, you know, you're being asked, you know, why are you opening the garage door to your own home?
Yeah, it's a true story.
So there's a link between bringing slaves and having a policeman ask you whose car this is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I think one of the reasons, and I don't think I ever questioned it, but I think there was a moment where I was kind of really deep diving once I was probably had written, I don't know, maybe about a third of the poems when I knew this was going to be a collection, but I really wanted to parse. I was like, well, I know the themes I want to present, right? I knew I wanted to present about inheritance. I knew I wanted to present about genealogy in a way. But I didn't know if I was going to intentionally, or actually, I think a better way to put it, omit some of the racial implications of some of these poems, right? Because I didn't know if I knew a theme I wanted it to be, and I didn't know if I wanted, if that was going to overshadow or distract or whatever. And what I realized writing these poems is that it's there, because I am writing about a life experience and I had no shortage of these experiences. And so, you know, that poem Waves, and why I enjoy that poem in writing is because I really do feel like in a pretty compact poem, it gets at the intersection of so many things that I kind of have struggled with. And, you know, I do have a certain cynicism to me, right? I have, you know, an activist background, and I am very engaged in social politics, you know, local and national. And I have my own life experiences and my parents' life experiences and things like that. And so I think not everyone has this outlook, but for me, it's very easy to be cynical. And that's one of the things that I've, like, tried to not be so pervasive about around my daughter, because I don't, you know, I want her to see the world as wondrous and decide what it is for herself without an overt expression from me. And so in that poem, and that is a true story, I felt very guilty. I felt very guilty about the possible introduction of the cynicism to my daughter. And then, you know, 2 hours later, I'm pulled over because our car is a little too nice. Like, I wasn't speeding. I didn't change, you know, directions. It was one of those things that he said, I pumped my brakes a couple times too many, and he thought I might be intoxicated, which I don't drink. I don't do anything like that. Right. It was this BS excuse. And it wasn't that I was validated in my cynicism. Or at least it wasn't that I was validated in showing my cynicism to my daughter, but I did feel validated in the cynicism that I showed earlier in the day, right? And so I was trying to make a distinction between those things of how you can see I came to a particular, you know, justification or line of thinking, and how I still wanted to not necessarily project that onto my daughter.
And she must have been in the car, right?
Yes.
So she's witnessed this. And does she, has she commented on it? And, you know, what do you think she's taking in?
I mean, she's witnessed it. And I think there are, because so rarely, like something that has not happened in front of my daughter is like someone just came up to me and called me a racial slur, right? That hasn't happened to my daughter. And so there's, I would imagine for her, there's still this ambiguity to things. And there's still a questioning of why things happen. And then they still happen for me at 40 years old, you know, 41 years old. So, you know, she's like, why did you do something wrong? And I'm like, no. Then why did he pull us over? It's like, well, he thought I did something wrong, or he thought something may be wrong. Right. And so you start to breach these conversations. And I don't know, you know, that conversation that I had with her, it didn't end with, well, I think this was a racist act by this police officer. It ended with, he may have had a bias towards something. He may have saw me and thought something that may not be true. Right. And I think, and that isn't to shield her from racism. I think it's, I want to give her the stepping stones of how that conceptualizes in someone's mind. And I mean, there's another poem in the book that is very overt towards that, which is I believe the title is Looking Over My Shoulder, She Discovers a Lynching. You know, so she's seen expressions of this, but I don't know that she has that full concept of what racism can actually lead to all the time, right? As a concrete thing, you know, even in that poem about the lynching, I would imagine that might be a standalone incident for her and not necessarily something that is pervasive. And so my wife and I have started to have those conversations when things come up, but I don't know. And I don't know what she's taken from me yet. Again, I've tried to be very careful for her to be able to see the world through her eyes and not mine, but I don't know yet. And that's one of those things, I guess, we're going to kind of find out. You know, she'll say something that surprises me every once in a while. But she also is growing up in a very different environment than I did. You know, her school is a pretty evenly racial mix. They're much more liberally and socially aware than like it was when I went to high school. And so there's a lot of things that we can head off at the pass, or like the administration, things like that, are very aware of that. Like, just, I think my high schooling just didn't care. and so she might see more promise and hope than I did, or I do, because of the environment. I just don't know yet. Still know.
And you grew up as a black youth, right?
Yeah.
Did your parents at some point have that conversation?
Oh yeah. They kind of had to, and again, this might be something that happens. Again, my daughter's only 8. I don't remember, you know, when I was her age, I wasn't living in the suburbs yet, right? I was we hadn't moved to suburbs yet, so that my experience was a little different. And then, you know, by the time I got to high school, yeah, like my dad had a very concrete conversation with me that was like, I know these are your friends and I want you to have friends and trust in your friends, but like, I need you to understand that like, if something happens, you may not get the same circumstances. And so you need to be aware and be guarded on yourself. I think that, in the previous book, I wrote about this a couple times about, I written a poem about being at a party where there was drinking and I wasn't drinking, but I was the only one that was taken downtown, even though I was one of like 30 different kids at this party. But I was the only black kid and I was the only person that got arrested. So there were situations that I think were kind of forced into those conversations that I had with my parents. And, you know, like, you know, again, my parents grew up in the 60s. Like, they saw some real, real stuff firsthand, which isn't to say that I haven't, but I didn't see what they did, you know? And so even my experience that I would relate to my daughter is going to be different than what my parents relate to me.
Yeah, thank God, too. Although you have to fight to keep the gains, whatever gains are made, all the time.
Right, right. And you would think, you know, there's a conversation I'll never forget. It was, I used to work at a hospital, and the summer that kicked off with Mike Brown's death. And then, of course, just a flurry of officer-involved shootings that happened after that. And I remember there was an older black man that had came in, and I think he was just coming in. I can't remember when he was coming in. He was in the waiting room, and there happened to be something on TV about one of these shootings. And I went to check him in, and he just apologized to me. He apologized to me that people his age should have endured all this so that we didn't. And I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that. And it just was this, it was this moment of this idea that, like, exactly what you said, you got to fight for the gains, and we wish we didn't have to, right? We wish there was a floor, so to speak, right? You achieve a level, you never dip below that again. But I think we've been shown time and time again that's not necessarily the case. And I do worry about that. Of course, I worry about that when it comes to my daughter. But yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's very true.
And so I just would like to end with this lovely note to your daughter. It's not even really a poem, I don't think, at the very end.
Yes.
Page 147, because I think it really, kind of sums up and expresses a lot of what you said here.
Sure. So yeah, this is at the very end of the book. What happens when black bodies are still full of life and ambition, when they refuse to be moved? I've planted a stake in a neighborhood and a future, and have decided that nothing will move me so easily. My father, who was born after the dawn of the civil rights era, is still here. I, the boy who can chart the violence against him through the neighborhoods he has lived, am still here. When my father is gone, and when I go, there is another, my daughter, who may have to fight in similar ways. She may have to rebel in similar ways, but she will do it from her own plot, a governance unto herself. We aren't going anywhere.
That's so lovely. William Evans, not only are these poems powerful and truth-telling, but they so express the tender love that you have for your daughter that is just, it's just beautiful to read. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mesa, for saying that. Thank you for the attentive read, and I'm really grateful that the book is out there and that it has had some resonance with folks. I really appreciate that.
William Evans. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to more poems from the collection We Inherit What the Fires Left, as well as a link to Evans reading more of his work. Next up, is the coronavirus pandemic going to lead to even more monopoly power than we already have? Stay tuned for our conversation with Matt Stoller. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Climate activist Naomi Klein coined the phrase the shock doctrine after Hurricane Katrina to describe how economic and political elites exploit large-scale disasters to promote their interests to the detriment of those of everyone else. The COVID-19 pandemic bids fair to follow the shock doctrine on steroids. Some have predicted the death of small business throughout America, leaving only the biggest players to dictate prices and crush labor rights. The monopolization of the economy will accelerate with dire consequences for democracy and economic security, my guest Matt Stoller says in his blog post, Antitrust After the Coronavirus, A Government of Corporate Monopolies. Stoller has dedicated himself to studying and writing about the politics of monopoly and finance. He worked in Congress for 6 years during the last financial crisis as a policymaker in finance and trade law, and he recently came out with the book Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. Later in the season, we'll talk with him about that book. But today, we called him up to talk about his blog post, Antitrust After the Coronavirus. Well, Matt Stoller, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
We are in a very a pregnant moment, I would say, when it comes to things like antitrust. There have been people who have forecast that when we come out of this pandemic, that they're, you know, basically small businesses will have gone away and there will just be a few large corporations serving us, which is a prospect that is horrifying to contemplate. And this article, Antitrust After the Coronavirus, A Government of Corporate Monopolies, centers itself on that. You write right in the beginning that societies reveal their core values at the moments of crisis. What core values is the U.S. revealing right now?
Well, I think across the West, you know, the U.S. is maybe more intense version of what we're seeing everywhere. The people that do the work in our society don't really have a lot of control over the work. That's the basic problem that we've had since the late 1970s, early 1980s, and it's gotten more and more extreme, where in our culture, you know, it's really the middlemen who are in control, the middlemen being, you know, people in finance, so Wall Street. These are people that are supposed to match our national savings to our national production, but they are now in this incredibly empowered position. Middlemen like Amazon, middlemen like Walmart, or certain actors that are similar to those companies, but in the medical space, all across our economy, we're governed by middlemen. And these middlemen, who are often monopolists or financiers, private equity, they also control our politics. So they've persuaded the elite political class that they are essential, even though they're not, even though what's really happening is people that are essential are nurses and doctors and people at the grocery stores we're seeing and farmers. But that's what our infrastructure has been revealed as one that prioritizes the wrong things. There are a lot of other ways to go into it. You can look at our dependencies on China, which we didn't notice for 25 years as we sent all our factories over there. You can look at a lot of problems with resiliency and how we make and distribute things. But essentially, they've revealed that we have been governing ourselves with PR rather than with substance and forethought for many decades.
And you talk about two stages, the clarifying stage and the reaction stage, both being really important. Right now, we're kind of in the clarifying stage. The people, you say, are waking up. You know, the mask is falling from the face of this monopoly power. And you say that the pandemic has both revealed and amplified this crisis of concentration. Give us some examples of that concentration as is being shown in this pandemic.
Right. So we're seeing substantial shortages of medical equipment. And the reason is because you've concentrated the supply chain of those of medical equipment in the hands of a few companies. And then often that supply chain has also been offshore to China. So you see shortages. We can't make what we need. And typically before World War II, when we had shortages, you know, usually there were a number of different producers. So you had some capacity that you could expand. If there was a problem with one producer, you could go to a different producer. And that's not the case today. You know, so we're seeing a lot of problems there. So one of the things that monopolists do is they tend, you know, they often raise prices on consumers or they reduce prices to suppliers or workers. So they increase what they get from what they sell and they reduce what they pay to what they buy. So for hospitals, it's no different, right? When you have market power in a hospital and you're a hospital, what you do is you increase prices, which is one of the main reasons why healthcare is extremely expensive. But you know what? Another thing that monopolists do is they cut capacity. They reduce the amount that they sell to control prices. So, you know, if you reduce the amount that you sell, you can increase the price. And you also don't have to make as much. So that's what a lot of monopolies or a lot of concentrated markets do. Hospitals are no different. And in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, you've seen a wave of consolidations of hospitals and doctor practices. And in New York in particular, you saw a number of hospitals close over the last 10 years, and they've reduced the number of beds, you know, which is that's their output. Hospitals have beds. And so you've seen a dramatic decline in the number of beds in New York and the number of beds per capita, hospital beds per capita all over the nation. And, you know, that they do that because they say, oh, it's more efficient. We don't need all of this redundant capacity. But it turns out that in a pandemic, you probably do need that redundant capacity. So an example of the problem. And then, you know, we've also seen this with ventilators, where we have a lot of hospitals, they carry very little spare capacity, and a lot, and in our supply chains for the last, really since the 1980s and 90s, we have what's called a just-in-time manufacturing capacity, where you try to keep as little inventory on hand as possible, because that's cheaper, right? You don't have to carry as much working capital, which is probably more efficient, except when you have a supply chain disruption, then all of a sudden you have no spare capacity. And I think we've seen that with a number of different sort of products and services. A lot of hospitals have very little inventory on hand, so they're running out of gloves and masks and you know, various forms of basic medication. And then the last kind of example, which the New York Times did a couple of weeks ago, but is not the only case of this, is when the government actually was trying to build up a national stockpile of ventilators. And they started doing this in 2007 when they noticed, you know, SARS could have been really dangerous over here, which was another respiratory disease that didn't spread. So the government said, we're gonna buy a bunch of ventilators so we have some capacity. And they went to a small company called Newport Medical. And Newport Medical, can you make a cheap ventilator for us? Most ventilators were around $10,000. They went to Newport. They said, can you make one for $3,000? We'll give you a contract. Newport said, sure. Eventually, they came out with working prototypes. And then a much larger medical device maker, which is called Covidien, ended up buying Newport. And Covidien also made ventilators. So they closed down the cheaper ventilator product line, because why would you want to sell a cheaper product than the one that you already sell, where you make more money from it? So there you have the government never got its cheap ventilators stockpile. And so today, you know, that was really good forethought by the government, good planning. But because of a merger, that they just, the other agencies in the government that were not part of the people trying to buy ventilators just allowed it to go through, they killed that ability to have that stockpile. So the lack of resiliency, redundancy, spare capacity is a direct result of bad enforcement of our merger laws. Laws against mergers are part of our body of law called antitrust, which is really the law that controls corporate power. And we really haven't enforced that for 30, 40 years. And because of that, we have a lot of the concentration problems that we're seeing right now, we see in the form of shortages or inability to actually manage a pandemic. But they're really also a problem of corporate concentration.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Matt Stoller. He is the author of the newsletter Big and also the author of the book Goliath, the 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. So I wanted to ask you about this, the hospital bed shortage, particularly in New York, because you also write in this article, in this piece, Antitrust After the Coronavirus, that you usually go into a crisis with the policymakers who got you into trouble. And Governor Andrew Cuomo actually cut 20,000 hospital beds over the last 10 years and just passed a $2.5 billion Medicaid cut in the middle of a pandemic. He says, we're out of money. His hands are tied. I wonder if you could talk about, you know, the policymakers who work within this system of monopoly and abet it.
Yeah, so Cuomo's a good example. There was a commission, I forgot what it's called, but there was a commission, I guess it was about 10 years ago, that looked into hospital costs in New York State, because hospital costs in New York State are really high. Even compared to American hospital costs, New York hospital costs are even higher. In America, is the highest in the world by far. So, okay, so what does this commission recommend? They recommend that you cut hospital capacity, because it's just too expensive. So, you know, Cuomo does. So, you know, a couple years later, now you have this pandemic. It's a huge problem. But what the commission was doing and what Cuomo was doing, that what they missed, was that really the cost problem is not the function of the fact that we have too much capacity. I mean, there are a lot of different countries that have a lot more beds per capita than we do. So it's like we pay the highest cost in the world by far, but, you know, at least twice as money as of every other country, to have fewer beds ready in a pandemic. What's really going on is market power. The hospitals, you know, and they've consolidated so that they can control an entire region so that they can charge a lot more money than they otherwise would be able to. And that's what's happened all over the country. It's pretty bad in New York. So you have really, really expensive hospital costs. You also have really high costs for pharmaceuticals, really high costs for insurance companies, for ambulances and medical devices. It's all very concentrated as a function of market power. So there was a 2003 New England Journal of Medicine article which said, here's why America has high healthcare costs. They said, it's the prices, stupid. That's the quote. It's just really high prices because they have market power. And rather than just addressing those prices, but saying, we're going to force you to lower your prices with price controls or by enforcing more competitive markets, by forcing hospitals to compete with one another, or any of the number of things that you could do, they just decided to close down capacity. So they cut muscle and bone instead of fat out of the system.
And when Cuomo says we're out of money, there's just nothing more we can do, what's your response to that?
Well, I would say there's nothing more that you can do if you're not willing to take on, you know, the vested interests of the hospital administrators and private equity guys that own these hospitals or that own doctor staffing companies. I mean, a lot of the American healthcare system is just a bunch of giant financial predatory bureaucracies that have a side hustle delivering a little bit of care, right? It's not that they're necessarily bad at delivering care. There are some excellent hospitals and excellent doctors in the United States, but increasingly, because of the way that we've run healthcare policy, delivering care is a secondary goal. The primary goal is to make sure that the billing systems are up and running. And that's a huge problem. I mean, we've seen a massive controversy even before the pandemic with something called surprise billing, which is basically a form of fraud where they treat you in a hospital where your insurance company says, oh yeah, you can be treated in this hospital. But then they have a doctor that's technically not on that hospital's staff treat you. And then they're like, oh, your insurance doesn't cover that. 2 weeks later, after you're out of the hospital, they send you a bill for a large amount of money. Surprise! You know, and private equity funds that own these doctor staffing companies and do this. And it's just like there's no other industry where you get a service. They tell you, here's the service that we're going to give you. You absolutely need it because you'll die otherwise. And then they don't even tell you what they're going to charge you until 2 weeks later. It's just crazy. It's not even crazy. It's just a form of predation. And it should be illegal. And there's debates in Congress about it. But that's not a system where the people that are organizing that system are thinking about how to more effectively deliver care. That's a system where the financial middlemen are running the policy. And nobody's happy with it. It's a really malevolent way to organize a society.
Yeah, and then let's talk a little bit about the stimulus bill. And we have to say, this is really a bipartisan issue. Our bipartisan political elites are implicated in what happens in this way. You say the reason this bill had little opposition, despite its size, as opposed to, let's say, you know, the hue and cry that happens when we talk about Medicare for all or getting rid of student debt, this had little opposition despite its size because it reinforced existing power hierarchies. It isn't about building a stronger government. It's just enlarging a weak state. Explain that.
So the New Deal in the 1930s was really controversial because Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the populist Democrats were attacking financier control of the economy and society. So they displaced the robber barons from running America. They also enlarged the public state, but that wasn't the primary goal. In many ways, they reduced the centralization of American society by breaking up a lot of large companies that were very powerful and by breaking up the financial empires like J.P. Morgan. So there was a fight over social power. In other countries, that didn't happen. You saw an enlargement of the state, but you didn't necessarily see the breaking of the robber barons. And what you're seeing right now is from the 1980s onward, I go into this in Goliath, this is the sort of the story, the way that they tricked us into giving up our understanding of taking on and decentralizing corporate power was by saying, that's not part of the debate. The debate is just whether you want a big government with high taxes on the wealthy than giving some transfer payments to the poor, or whether you want a small government with low taxes on the wealthy and fewer transfers to the poor. The whole idea that the government has a role in structuring markets and breaking up companies, that's just silly and unimportant, right? Now, that's the tradition I come at it from. I don't want to see a big or a small government. I just want to see a fair society. And I think most Americans don't want to see, you know, they don't want to have a large incompetent public government, but they also don't want to have a large malevolent private government like Facebook. Facebook shouldn't be structuring our public discourse, but they are. That's a governing role. It's not a, you know, it's called a business, but Mark Zuckerberg talks about his company as a government. He's building a Supreme Court. There's all of these questions of sovereignty. So what Trump is doing and what Democrats and Republicans are doing with the stimulus and with the coronavirus is they're not actually trying to take on the financiers that have kind of broken our public governing apparatus. What they're trying to do is they're just trying to hand over our governing apparatus to those financiers. So the Federal Reserve is financing a lot of borrowing from private equity and large corporations. A lot of the other, you know, the hospitals financing piece, the government is actually not, you know, they put $100 billion, they're going to put even more into hospitals, but they're not directly taking over the hospitals and saying, we're going to have a public infrastructure running our hospital system, which is what they did in Spain. They just nationalized the hospitals temporarily. What they're doing here is they just gave United Healthcare, which is a private health insurance, Trump just gave them the money and said, you give this to hospitals. So it's like the private financiers and sort of aristocrats that have been running and mismanaging our culture, they're just getting access to taxpayer funds to do it even more so. And that's why the coronavirus bailouts, even though they were like they radically enlarged government, they didn't see pushback from sort of quote-unquote small government types because those guys were never really about having a particular size of government. They were just about keeping the aristocrats on top. And in some ways, this bill and the bills that have been coming out keep the aristocrats on top and even give them more power. Now, I'm not – this seems like a bummer. I'm not trying to be a bummer here because I actually have reasons to think that this is not a permanent – this is the sort of what's it called? This is the clarifying moment. We still have to react as a society, right? It takes some time before we kind of get to come to grips with what's happening. And we can react, we can choose how to react. That's the great thing about being in a democracy. We don't have to tolerate this. But right now there is the clarifying moment, and the policymakers who have got us into this problem, whether it's Andrew Cuomo or whether it's Donald Trump or, you know, they're all hiring McKinsey, which is the problem, to kind of figure out how to get us out of it. And that, you know, it's going to take some time before we can build a political apparatus to say, no, actually, we want to reorient how we do things. We want more decentralization. We want more resiliency. We want more social justice. We want a smarter, safer society.
Yeah, that's great. And you actually have some suggestions on how to do that. You talk about, well, one thing that has already, I think, been discussed is a moratorium on mergers. You can explain that. You say that's a good first step, but we are going to need a lot more. So first, just say what that merger moratorium is briefly, and then talk about, you talk about a temporary pandemic antitrust act. I'd like to know more about it, and then also ask you why temporary?
So merger moratorium would stop companies that have access to credit, you know, big companies and private equity funds, it would stop them from using their ability to access credit to take over companies that don't have access to credit. So that's just like, if you're a good enterprise, you're a good business, but you temporarily, you know, can't get any access to bank lending, you know, that puts you in a spot where you might have to sell out. And that's not fair, right? And it's not fair that you have to sell out to a competitor just because that competitor can borrow from the bank and you can't. So a merger prohibition would stop that, okay? But I think that, you know, you also need to expand credit programs, which Congress is sort of doing with the small business facility. But, you know, going forward in a year or two, we're going to have a situation where it's likely, you know, the big guys are going to be more powerful than they've been. You're going to see, you know, we mishandled the pandemic, so we're going to have a lot of small businesses that are out, that are done. And we're going to have to deal with a world with a lot of concentrated corporate power. So what we need is a commission, this is a post-pandemic or pandemic antitrust commission, which just does what's called no-fault monopolization enforcement, which is to say, we don't have to prove that you did bad things to gain monopoly power. We just have to show that you have a lot of power in your industry, and we're just going to break you apart. And because we've just decided as a society that it's really important to preserve economic liberty and small business. And that means that you gained a bunch of power in the pandemic because maybe you were in essential service, maybe you had access to capital that others didn't, who knows. But we're just going to say you get to run part of your company, but we're going to break up, maybe we're going to separate out the distribution arm from the retailing arm, or maybe we're going to break up into several different companies just so that we can have a society where we're not dependent on a small number of giant corporations. So that's one thing that you need to do. Another thing you need to do is there's going to be a lot of companies that have gone bankrupt, very small businesses, mid-size businesses, and you need to have basically a national mobilizing engine, like a public bank. In the 1930s, we had one was called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Put that together and say, we will help you restart your business, right? If you ran a bookstore, you went out of business because nobody could go to your bookstore, we're going to put you through a quick bankruptcy. We're going to give you some money to restart it. And same with your distributor, because we've decided that we want a world with bookstores. Same thing with restaurants. Same thing with like a whole bunch of different industries where, you know, you just went out of business. It's not necessarily your fault. That's what we need to do. If we decide that we, you know, we have an economy where we've shut down large swaths of the economy, and we're just going to have to make a decision politically about what we want our society to be doing. And that's just a political choice we're going to have to make. So what I'm saying is let's start getting in the mindset now of making that choice and setting up the institutions to let us make that choice. And there's a lot of things we need to do. Like there's a bunch of stuff we need to do to bring back productive capacity from China for a whole bunch of different stuff, you know, like medicine or whatever. And that's going to require a lot of people to do it. Fortunately, we can do it now. I mean, that's the one upside of having a lot of people who are not, you know, who don't have anything to do is if you have stuff you need them to do, you can match that pretty easily. So that's an opportunity now if you can get some political leadership. But then we also have, you know, things like climate change. You know, now is a really useful moment to say, okay, we're going to start to build a more resilient society around reducing carbon emissions. There's just a lot of things that we need to do. And we now have this really open question about what kind of country are we going to look like? We've demobilized a lot of our economy, and we need to put together institutions to remobilize it. And we have to start having those conversations about what that looks like.
Matt Stoller, you are the author of Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy, as well as the author of this post, Antitrust After the Coronavirus. And it's part of the blog that you run, which is big. It's excellent. I highly recommend it to all my listeners. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Matt Stoller. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his blog, Big, as well as to the article on it, Antitrust After the Coronavirus. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.